Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter Jr. and Anna Mateo. Later, we will present the next part in our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, an apple tree stands alone near the top of a hill. It produces the Arkansas Beauty, a fruit long believed to have disappeared from existence. 3 years ago, plant experts E.J. Brandt and David Benscotter rediscovered it. The men have found 13 long-lost apple varieties in an area once known as Oregon Territory in the northwestern United States. Brandt and Benscotter, both retirees, lead a nonprofit called Lost Apple Project. They travel hundreds of kilometers in trucks and on foot to find orchards planted by settlers more than a century ago. The two are racing against time to keep the fruit from disappearing. The apple trees are old and many are dying. Others are being ripped out for more wheat fields or housing developments. "To me, this area is a gold mine," said Brandt, who has found two historical varieties in the state of Idaho. "I don't want it lost in time. I want to give back to the people so that they can enjoy what our forefathers did." North America once had 17,000 named varieties of domesticated apples, but only about 4,000 remain. The Lost Apple Project believes settlers planted a few hundred varieties in their part of the Pacific Northwest alone. The Homestead Act of 1862 gave 65 hectares to families who would improve the land and pay a small fee. These people planted orchards with enough variety to get them through the long winter. They planted apples that ripen from early spring until the first freeze. Then, as now, people did not raise apples from seeds. People took cuttings taken from existing trees and then joined them with roots. The new trees do not have the genetic material that often makes wild apples unfit as food. Joni Cooper is a plant scientist at the Temperate Orchard Conservancy. She has helped identify many of the lost varieties found in northern Idaho and eastern Washington. The trees have value beyond their historic importance, she notes. The trees could help genetic diversity among modern-day apple crops as climate change and disease take an increasing toll. Cooper said, "You have to have varieties that can last, that can grow, produce fruit, survive the heat, and maybe survive the cold winter, depending on where you are. I think that's critical."
Many world leaders are gathering in Madrid, Spain, to discuss how to reduce the world's temperatures. As they meet, China is expected to receive a lot of attention. China is the largest producer of carbon gases linked to rising temperatures. China burns about half the coal used in the world each year. Coal is a fossil fuel that releases carbon dioxide and other gases when it is burned. Between 2000 and 2018, China's yearly carbon gas emissions increased by nearly 200%. China now releases about 30% of the world's total. However, China is also the leading market for solar energy devices, wind turbines, and electric vehicles. It builds about two-thirds of the world's solar cells, which create electricity from sunlight. Kevin Tu is with the Center on Global Energy Policy at Columbia University and works in Beijing. We are witnessing many contradictions in China's energy development, he said. It's the largest coal market and the largest clean energy market in the world. But China's government notes that the country's yearly economic growth has slowed to about 6%. That is China's lowest level of growth in 25 years. Chinese officials are increasing their support for coal and other heavy industries. That is because those industries are important parts of China's energy system and economy. At the same time, the country is reducing subsidies for renewable energy. Recent media reports and satellite pictures suggest that China is building or planning to complete new coal power centers with a total electricity production of 148 gigawatts. That number is nearly equal to all the electricity produced by coal in the European Union. That estimate comes from Global Energy Monitor, a nonprofit organization based in San Francisco. Separately, investment in China's renewable energy industries dropped almost 40% in the first half of 2019 compared with the same period last year. That information comes from Bloomberg New Energy Finance, a research organization. Last week in Beijing, China's Vice Minister of Ecology and Environment, Zhao Yingmin, spoke to reporters. He said energy resources that are not based on carbon already make up 14.3% of the country's electricity production. He did not say if China would promise to lower its emissions targets anytime soon. We are still faced with challenges of developing our economy, improving people's livelihoods, he said. Critics say China is the world's biggest producer of gases linked to climate change. Supporters say China is the biggest producer of clean energy equipment. However, both claims are somewhat misleading. China has a really mixed record. On the one hand, it's seen rapidly rising emissions over the past two decades, notes Jonas Nam, an energy expert at Johns Hopkins University. On the other hand, it's shown it's able to innovate around manufacturing and make new energy technologies available at scale, faster and cheaper, he said. Bloomberg New Energy Finance says China's manufacturing helped bring down the cost of solar panels by 80% between 2008 and 2013. Prices for wind turbines and lithium-ion batteries also dropped sharply because of Chinese manufacturers. If we have any chance to meet climate targets, we have to do a lot by 2030. And we won't be able to do it without China's clean energy supply chain, Nam said. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
Life expectancy rates in the United States have been increasing for most of the past 60 years, but a new study has confirmed changes. It found that U.S. life expectancy rates decreased for 3 years in a row after 2014. The main cause appears to be higher rates of death among middle-aged Americans. A report on the study appeared last week in JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association. The report notes that among working-age Americans, death rates for all causes increased between 2010 and 2017. The main reasons were drug overdoses, alcohol abuse, suicides, and organ system diseases, such as diabetes. Dr. Stephen Wolf helped to prepare the report. He is Director Emeritus of the Center on Society and Health at Virginia Commonwealth University. Wolf said there has been an increase in death rates among working-age Americans. This is an emergent crisis, and it is a uniquely American problem, since it is not seen in other countries. Something about life in America is responsible. The rising rates of midlife mortality hit some areas of the country harder than others, the report said. Increases were highest in northern New England and the Ohio Valley. Economic hardship and the resulting despair, a sense of hopelessness, may be to blame, Wolf said. While it's a little difficult to place the blame on despair directly, the living conditions causing despair are leading to other problems, he explained. For example, if you live in an economically distressed community where income is flat and it's hard to find jobs, that can lead to chronic stress, which is harmful to health. Wolf noted that other high-income countries do not have the problem of increasing mortality rates in middle age. He added this might be because in other countries, there are more support systems for people who fall on hard times. In America, families are left to their own devices to try to get by. Information from the study came from the National Center for Health Statistics and the U.S. Mortality Database for 1959 to 2017. The researchers also examined medical literature for studies of U.S. life expectancy and mortality rates. Based on the researchers' findings, life expectancy increased by almost 10 years, from 69.9 to 78.9 years during that period. But they found that rates had been falling since 2014. The current problems we are seeing are decades in the making, Wolf said. We used to have the highest life expectancy in the world. The pace at which life expectancy was increasing in the U.S. started to fall off relative to other countries in the 1980s. Dr. John Rowe is a professor at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health in New York City. The new findings provide evidence of some worrying trends. It is depressing, he said, but I don't think it's much of a surprise. He noted the problem of opioids in the United States, saying that 250,000 Americans have overdosed and died after taking the drugs. What is unusual is that the decrease in life expectancy is not the same for all age groups. This is really evidence that mortality rates are increasing only in middle age, while they are continuing to decline in children, adolescents, and people over 65, he said. I'm Ana Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. By the summer of 1862, the American Civil War had been going on for more than a year. The Union had won some battles. The Confederacy had won others. But neither side was in a position to win the war. President Abraham Lincoln needed a major victory. He was losing the support of both politicians and the public. A major victory would not only help him that way, it would also make it easier for him to make an important announcement. For a number of months, he had been planning an announcement about the black people held as slaves in the South. Today, Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe tell about Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation.
At the end of August 1862, Confederate troops under the command of Robert E. Lee defeated the main Union army at Manassas, Virginia. The battlefield was less than 50 kilometers from Washington. The year before, Confederate troops had sent the Union army fleeing from that same battlefield. Now, they had done it again. With this latest victory, General Lee decided on a major move. He would carry the war into the northern states. Lee took his army of 60,000 men across the Potomac River into Maryland. He ordered some of his men to capture the Union position at Harper's Ferry. He moved the others to Sharpsburg, a town on the Potomac River. He put his men into position along Antietam Creek, just outside of town. His lines extended almost 3 kilometers. There, at Antietam, he would make his stand. He was still close enough to Virginia to withdraw if the Union force following him proved too strong.
The Union force arrived in the middle of September. It did not attack immediately. It spent one full day getting into position along Antietam Creek, across from the Confederate Army. It attacked the following day at sunrise. The Union general, George McClellan, planned to attack all along the Confederate line at the same time. But this did not happen. First, Union troops attacked one end of the line, which extended into a field full of tall corn plants. Then they attacked the center of the line, which was in an old, deeply sunken road that gave it good protection. Finally, they attacked at the other end of the line. For each northern attack, General Lee was able to move men to where they were needed. The northern troops got within 25 meters of the Confederate line, but they could not break through anywhere.
On the first day of battle at Antietam, Lee lost 25% of his men. On the second day, the two armies faced each other without firing. They were too tired to fight. As they rested, however, fresh Union soldiers moved into position. Lee knew they would attack with full force the next day. He knew he could not win. Sadly, he ordered his men back to Virginia. It was now clear Antietam was a northern victory. It was not a complete victory. The Union army could have chased the Confederate army and destroyed it. But General McClellan did not do this. He was satisfied that he had stopped the invasion.
In Washington, President Lincoln welcomed the news. He had waited a long time for a northern victory. A few days after the battle, Lincoln held a special meeting with his cabinet. He talked about the Declaration on Slavery, which he had prepared. It would free Negro slaves in the rebel states of the South. "As you remember," he said, "I put the Declaration aside several weeks ago until I could issue it supported by a military victory. The action of the army against the rebels has not been exactly what I should have liked, but the rebels have been driven out of Maryland, and Pennsylvania is no longer in danger of invasion." President Lincoln said he thought the time was right to announce the Emancipation Proclamation. The cabinet made some minor changes in the document, and Lincoln signed it.
Newspapers printed the proclamation. This is what it said.
"I, Abraham Lincoln, President of the United States and Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy, do hereby declare that on the first day of January, 1863, all persons held as slaves within any state then in rebellion against the United States shall then become and be forever free. The government of the United States, including the military and naval forces, will recognize and protect the freedom of such persons, and will interfere in no way with any efforts they may make for their actual freedom."
President Lincoln had tried to keep the question of slavery out of the Civil War. To him, there was just one reason for fighting: to save the Union. Nothing meant more to him than preventing the nation from splitting up. Lincoln feared that the issue of slavery would weaken the Northern war effort. Many men throughout the North would fight to save the Union. They would not fight to free the slaves. Lincoln also needed the support of the four slave states that did not leave the Union: Delaware, Kentucky, Maryland, and Missouri. He could not be sure of their support if he declared that the purpose of the war was to free the slaves. As Lincoln waited for a Union victory to announce his Emancipation Proclamation, he wrote a letter to the New York Tribune newspaper. The letter was to prepare the public for what was to come. This is what Lincoln said.
"My chief object in this struggle is to save the Union. It is not either to save or destroy slavery. If I could save the Union without freeing any slave, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing all the slaves, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing some and leaving others alone, I would also do that. What I do about slavery and the colored race, I do because I believe it helps to save the Union. This is how I see my official duty. It does not change my wish as a person that all men everywhere could be free."
President Lincoln failed to keep the question of slavery out of the Civil War. As the war went on, month after long month, people in the North began to see it as more than a struggle for national unity. They began to see it as a struggle for human freedom. Abolitionists were active. In speeches and writings, they said over and over again that slavery was evil. As public opinion began to change, anti-slavery members of Congress gained more power. By the summer of 1862, they had enough support to pass laws ending slavery in Washington, D.C., and United States territories. They also pushed through Congress a bill that would do much to end slavery in the states.
The bill was called the Confiscation Act. It gave the federal government the power to confiscate or seize the property of all persons who supported the Southern Rebellion. Slaves were considered property, so any slaves seized under the act would become free immediately. Slaves who escaped from rebel slave owners also would be free. The bill would not affect slaves owned by persons who supported the Union. President Lincoln did not like the Confiscation Act. He thought it interfered with his wartime powers as commander-in-chief.
However, Lincoln was under great pressure from abolitionists, so he signed the new law. But he did not plan to enforce it. He still hoped for a plan that would free the slaves slowly, over time. He proposed such a plan, but only for the border states between North and South. Under his plan, the federal government would buy slaves in the border states and free them. Lawmakers from the border states rejected Lincoln's plan, and that is when he decided to issue the Emancipation Proclamation.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.